Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, this September 14th, 2008. And it is my pleasure today. We'll be talking with one of the great journalists in America today, one of the fine editors from one of the magazines with the longest tradition of covering politics in this country. Matt Rothschild, editor of The Progressive, will be our guest today on Media Matters. But first, before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
By the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The group that's assembled here today represents Twin Cities journalists, independent media makers, and others who care deeply about press freedom. We have brought with us the support of more than 50,000 Americans to deliver St. Paul Mayor Chris Coleman a message. Mayor Coleman, journalism is not a crime.
Last week, journalists and citizens of St. Paul, Minnesota, gathered at St. Paul City Hall to demand that charges be dropped for all journalists arrested while covering the Republican National Convention. Nancy Doyle Brown of the Twin Cities Media Alliance led the charge that delivered more than 50,000 letters collected by nonpartisan media reform group Free Press.
Over the past week, journalists have been detained and arrested, subjected to raids, pepper sprayed, and more simply for showing up to work. These have been dark days for press freedom in the United States.
Journalists were in St. Paul to report on the RNC, both inside the Excel Center and out in the streets. Reporters with Eyewitness Video, a New York-based video collective, were held at gunpoint during a preemptive raid aimed at disrupting protesters. During the convention, journalists were swept up in mass arrests with protesters and bystanders, detained for several hours to several days, and had their equipment confiscated. Some were roughed up by police. Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman, Sharif Abdel-Quddus, and Nicole Salazar also attended the petition drop. All three were among those arrested. Salazar filmed her own arrest.
Get out of here!
I was telling them that I'm press, please let me pass. And one of the officers, I think he was trying to drag me, he was grabbing my leg. And another officer put his boot on my back and was pressing me to the ground.
Also among the arrested were two filmmakers from Pepper Spray Productions, Joseph Lissac and Lambert Rochford. Rochford, who was also arrested during the 2004 RNC, says that independent journalists aren't taken as seriously as mainstream journalists, and they are seen as more of a threat.
Journalists who are independent, who aren't, like, you know, affiliated with a big, like, corporate news outlet, and who are choosing to cover things that the state would rather not get media attention, such as, you know, protest, it tend to be targeted by the police because they see us as a threat to their ideology. I mean, we're putting out media that's contrary to what they want people to know about and believe.
But mainstream journalists were also arrested. Among them, Associated Press photographer Matt Rourke, a reporter from the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and several other local journalists and photographers. Mike Busco of the Minnesota Newspaper Guild was appalled by the heavy-handed treatment of journalists.
The convention happens inside and outside. It's an event. And if journalists are not free to do their jobs, then the democracy is not served.
Jason Barnett of The Uptake, a group of citizen video journalists, said that those reporting on an event should not be arrested for unlawful assembly.
The police would say, disperse, and you have 10 minutes to disperse or whatever. And the assumption is that if you're a journalist, you know, from the police, that you're supposed to disperse. Well, if you disperse when they tell you to, then you're not covering the story. The journalists really are supposed to stay there at that time.
Back up!
Are we all gonna die by firing squad? What?
Put your hands on
Geraldine Cahill of The Real News was arrested with her videographer. She gave this report.
One officer told me while I was sitting on the bridge that the media can embed themselves with police and not get into trouble. Does this sound familiar? So much for the Fourth Estate.
Special thanks to The Uptake, Democracy Now!, St. Paul Pioneer Press, and The Real News for their audio clips. For links to these clips and more, go to freepress.net/Media Minutes. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest is someone who's been on the program several times, but not for over a year now. Editor of the Progressive magazine, author of the highly acclaimed book, You Have No Rights and the State of Civil Liberties in the United States Today. Radio show host, blogger, journalist extraordinaire, and political commentator. It's my guest, my pleasure to welcome to our mobile studio, my guest, Matt Rothschild.
Hey, Bob. Thanks so much for having me back on.
Well, it's terrific to have you here. And before we get into the politics of the day, which we're going to be talking about for the next 53 minutes, Matt, a little bit about the Progressive magazine, because I think there might be some listeners not necessarily familiar with this fine institution.
Well, the exciting thing for us is the Progressive is going to be 100 years old next year, starting in January. The magazine was founded in January 1909 by Robert La Follette, fighting Bob La Follette, the senator from Wisconsin, who was one of the pioneers of the Progressive movement. And unlike the other pioneer of the Progressive movement, Teddy Roosevelt, fighting Bob La Follette was an anti-imperialist and opposed U.S. entry into World War I. And we've continued that anti-imperialist tradition that the Progressive movement was embodied, certainly with La Follette and others like him. So we're going to have a big celebration here in Madison, Wisconsin on May 1st and 2nd. And we're going to have Jim Hightower, Robert Redford, Cindy Sheehan. I'm hoping Amy Goodman will come. You're going to be there, I hope, and John Nichols and others. So it's going to be a lot of fun. And we're also putting together a book, The Best of the Progressive, which is going to be published by the New Press in the spring. And we're going to have a special issue of the magazine that's going to be about five or six times the regular size. And it's going to be a joy to put together. We're going to have about two pages on each year, just taking the best little snippets from that year and putting it across a couple pages of the Progressive magazine. So it's an exciting time. I've been there 25 years now. I always hope to make it to the 100th anniversary, and here we are.
Yeah, I think you will. For listeners who might not be familiar with the actual old school magazine, The Progressive, which comes out 12 times a year, once a month, what sort of stories do you cover? We've got the last few issues. What are the major stories that you've been covering in The Progressive?
Well, the cover of our September issue is by our culture editor, Liz DiNovello, who went to Jordan and to Syria and wrote a story on Iraq's forgotten refugees. Of course, there have been 2 million or 3 million refugees that the United States, that George W. Bush has caused with his reckless war in Iraq. We don't hear a lot about those refugees and the plight of those refugees. She visited some of those in Jordan and in Syria. We have interviews every month in The Progressive. We have one with the actor and director John Cusack in our September issue. We have columnists like Barbara Ehrenreich and Jim Hightower. And I do a little something called McCarthyism Watch sometimes, and I have an article in this issue on a guy who was with some peace groups and anti-death penalty groups in Maryland. His name's Max Abashevsky. He's a disciple of Philip Berrigan, very nonviolent person, and he was being spied on by the Maryland State Police for a couple years, several hundred hours. There were undercover cops in his planning meetings. I mean, I used to be a demonstrator and a protester before I was a journalist, Bob, and I can remember going to these planning meetings, and sometimes there's just three or four people there. And in one of those tiny meetings with three or four people that Max Abashevsky was holding, one of the women was a snoop. She was actually with the Maryland State Police undercover. Her gnome de snoop was Lucy Shoup. And she, even in one of the emails to Max Abashevsky, which he forwarded to me, she said, isn't that a funny name or something like that? So she was even making fun of her name, but he didn't know it was a made-up name and that she had a made-up identity. He thought she was a for real activist and only found out in the course of a lawsuit that the ACLU filed.
Well, Matt Rothschild, in your book, You Have No Rights, which New Press published in 2006 or 7.
2007.
2007, just last year. In that book, you chronicle the work you've been doing at the Progressive in the magazine and at the Progressive, just progressive.org website, about the attacks on civil liberties since 9/11 in the Bush administration. And has this tapered off at all in your sense? I mean, did we go through a really rough patch right after 9/11 and into 2004, and now finally they're backing off a little bit? Or what's the status of civil liberties from your perspective?
Well, there's more space for actors and singers. You know, the Dixie Chicks aren't getting their music banned and burned and stomped on in public displays of grotesque censorship anymore, and actors aren't losing their jobs like Susan Sarandon did shortly afterwards.
Susan Sarandon lost her job?
You know, she said there were fewer jobs coming her way, but she didn't, you know. That was, if that's the price to pay, she'll pay it. But now, you know, there are a lot of anti-war movies out there. They're not doing very well, but there are a lot of people speaking out with names. But what we saw in St. Paul, for instance, and the Media Minute talked about that, was the kind of repression that is now commonplace in America, that you can't protest without being in a so-called free speech zone, which should be anathema to Americans. This country is supposed to be a free speech zone. And the idea that we need to be penned up like cattle in a free speech zone for the right to express ourselves about a huge political issue, who's going to be the next president of the United States, I mean, that is appalling. And then
let me ask you about that, man. Let me interrupt you on that point if I can. I mean, it's not just a free speech issue or, in the case of beating up journalists or locking them up, free press issue. It's also one of the other five core freedoms of the First Amendment, which is the right to assemble and redress grievances. That's 4 and 5. You know, what does the right to assemble mean if you're penned off so no one in power has to see you? So you're cordoned off to, like, the warehouse district, and people in power can just go in their limos and never know you even exist.
Yeah, it's just, it's down the tubes. I mean, almost every aspect of the First Amendment is down the tubes. I mean, freedom of assembly, freedom of speech, freedom to petition your government for redress of grievances. If the government can't see you trying to point out what those grievances are, what kind of right? It's a real empty right. And so that's what's happened in this country. And it was like when they started to have commercials in the movie theaters, people at the beginning started to boo and hiss when the commercials came on. And now people accept it. It's the same thing with free speech zones. At the beginning, I would have hoped people would have booed and hissed. But now it's like, well, where's the free speech zone?
Our guest today, Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive magazine, has been working at the Progressive for 25 years, writing about civil liberties and politics and media in the United States for the past 2+ decades. We'd welcome your calls with questions or comments for Matt Rothschild here at 333-9455 and also 1-800-222-9455. And Matt, you also do a radio show every week, and you blog all the time. And people, I don't think, have access to the show here in Champaign-Urbana. Where can they listen to you? Can they download it on the web?
Yeah, it's up at progressive.org. You can just go there and find the guests that I've had on recently. I had Phil Donahue on recently, and he was great. He has this.
You're stealing all the good guests from me.
He's got this.
So I get the B-list.
Yeah, that's me. He's got this great film out called Body of War that chronicles the life of a Iraq vet who was paralyzed from the chest down, and shows this guy's Thomas's marriage and the dissolution of the marriage over time. And also Donahue runs the roll call of senators who voted for the war and some of the few heroes who voted against the war. And Robert Byrd is one of the biggest heroes in the movie. And he and Thomas finally meet at the end, which is a very poignant end to that movie. But Donahue, of course, was kicked off MSNBC right before the war started because the network said it was a bad face for the network to have on in times of war when other stations are waving the flag. And so, you know, that is a huge example of media censorship in this country by the corporate media.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild. Let's go to the phone lines. You've already got a caller who's been very patient. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Matt Rothschild.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I'm interested in Sarah Palin's comments on banning books. There was a on Bill Moyers' journal on Friday. Brooke Gladstone made the statement she did inquire about banning books, but and then goes on to say about the list that included books that weren't even published yet. Seems to me that's kind of irrelevant, and that was also on Media Matters today, and it's like they're assuming that this was a left-wing email that made up this list as opposed to covering up the issue of banning books, period, because some on the list were illegitimate.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Matt, I got that email. I don't know if you saw it, but it was a long list of books. And as the caller pointed out, several of them were published after this whole incident took place. And it's been discredited, and now it's been reversed that she didn't try to ban, like, there's a list of at least 100 or 200 books. But what do we know about Sarah Palin and book banning?
But I think the outlines of the story, though the details were false, the outlines were true, which is to say she wanted to get rid of some books that were in the library. And when the librarian resisted that, she tried to fire the librarian. And ultimately, the librarian was able to keep her job. But one of the books that she objected to, according to an article I saw in the New York Times, was a book about a gay dad, and she just didn't think that had any business being in the Wasilla Library, even though she evidently hadn't read the book.
Well, I would hope not. I mean, if you can't read a book you want to ban, can you? I mean, that sort of defeats...
I mean, I think America needs to come to grips with who this person is who may be, you know, one melanoma away from being president of the United States. I mean, this person seems to be very anti-intellectual, a kind of headstrong ignoramus. We've had a headstrong ignoramus in the White House here for 8 years who's been boastfully anti-intellectual, and Palin seems cut from the same cloth, and she has these very far-right ideas about creationism and about doing God's will, though she was trained to regurgitate that famous Lincoln line about just hoping that she was doing what God wanted, not telling people what God wanted when she was talking to Charlie Gibson. But that interview itself was a horrifying display of ignorance on her part.
Yeah, the whole issue of Sarah Palin's relationship to the media, or to be more accurate, McCain campaign management of Sarah Palin's relationship to the media, I think really it's fascinating, frightening, and should, I think, cause alarm bells to go off. The idea that a politician running for president or vice president will only speak to media who are carefully selected to be suitably deferential to them and has no obligation to speak to journalists except on their own particular terms. Have you ever heard of this before in American political history?
I haven't heard of it, Bob, but you used the right word, deferential, because the McCain campaign manager said people need to show more deference and the media needs to show more deference to Sarah Palin. It's not the media's job to show deference to anybody. We don't live in a monarchy. It's not our job to bow our heads when the monarchs or the appointed or nominated monarchs walk by. I mean, that's not our First Amendment system here. And, you know, what did they do? They put her in the witness protection program there for 10 days after she got the nomination. And then they just put her in front of Charlie Gibson.
Well,
and then no one
Matt,
else has to ask a question of
Matt
her.
Matt Rochelle, let me ask you this question. Let's just say, and this is going to obviously be hypothetical. Let's say that the McCain campaign refused to let Sarah Palin talk to any journalist, take any questions, and then they called you up, said, Matt Rothschild, we decided you're the one journalist we're going to have for a full hour with Sarah Palin. We're going to tape it, and you can use whatever you want. It's up to you to edit it. But, you know, you get that 1 hour, and you're the only journalist who's going to get a chance to talk to Sarah Palin. What would your response have been?
You know, that's a tough question. I think what I'd want to do is ask some of the other journalists whether they thought it was kosher for me to assume this responsibility for the entire Fourth Estate and to see whether it would be better simply to say, no, we're not going to play that game. And that's a tough one. I mean, I think maybe she'll go in front of Fox News at some point. That'll
her next one set up with Sean Hannity.
Yeah, well, there's a shocker. I mean, they're just playing the script now. I mean, they thought they could get an easy ride with Charlie Gibson because he was so bad in the primary debate with the Democratic candidates, and maybe he was a little tougher than they suspected. And she did look like the student who had studied the wrong question for the final exam. I mean, there was no question about that.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild, editor of The Progressive. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580. The phone numbers again, 333-9455, toll free, 1-800-222-9455. Matt Rothschild also hosts this program, Progressive Radio, which can be heard in Urbana on WRFU every Thursday at 4:30. That's at 104.5 FM. And WRFU in Urbana carries Matt's daily commentaries earlier in the 4 p.m. hour every day. So you do have a following here in Urbana, Matt Rothschild. Let's go to the phone lines now. Line 4, Indiana, you're on the air with Matt Rothschild.
Hello. I'd like to ask a speculative question. In regards to the warrantless wiretapping that Bush did, is any of that information being used against people who are going to protest against McCain and Phelan? That information I heard on the radio about how they treated the program just before this, how they treated the journalist in St. Paul, I didn't know about that, and that makes me worry about the news I'm watching. That's the reason I listen to this program. That sort of thing is, you know, we're back in the late 20s, early 30s in Germany, it seems to me, in some sense, without stretching it too far. I wonder if you could give some comments about the interrelationship between the Bush boys and McCain's people in terms of what information they could use from the wiretapping that they may have done to set up straw men to avert, you know, the journalists from one place to another and put, you know, roadblocks in their way. Thanks.
Thank you, caller.
Well, it's a good question. Unfortunately, I don't have any good information to answer it coherently or intelligently with hard information, so I hesitate to speculate. But it does concern me, this warrantless wiretapping, to be sure, and what use the FBI could make of this information that they're scooping up, what use the executive branch in general, and politically what use they could make of the information. One thing that has happened that relates to this is there's now sharing of information all the way from the local police when they are spying like they were in Maryland on this guy, Max Abashevsky, who was an anti-death penalty and peace activist. The state police spied on him undercover, and they sent the information all the way up to the NSA. And now it's going to be legal. There's a question as to whether that was legal at the time. But, of course, the Bush people are now rewriting the regulations, so that will be legal in the future. For any law enforcement department to share information all the way up to the CIA and the NSA, if they have any information on anybody, really. So then what kind of privacy do we have?
You know, Matt Rothschild, you've chronicled in You Have No Rights and in your McCarthy Watch at the Progressive, all these incidents of people who are peaceful activists, I mean, oftentimes religious activists, but invariably law-abiding people at the outer limits, maybe some civil disobedience, but people who certainly are nonviolent, they're anything but a threat in any sane sense, definition of the word, to the public safety. And I was wondering, as I'm listening to you and I've read your work, you know, all these sort of government mechanisms that are spying on these religious peace activists and people like that, are they also doing the same sort of stuff to these people who want to blow up abortion clinics and these sort of ultra-right white supremacist groups and lunatic Christian groups that, you know, basically think, you know, you can kill for your God whoever you want and no human law can stop you? Are they getting the same sort of surveillance in the United States, to your knowledge, that or could you do files on them as well?
Yeah, I don't know to the extent that the FBI has been spying on, you know, these far-right supremacist groups. I hope they are, especially with Barack Obama running. You know, you think the far-right white supremacists are a group to be concerned with if you want to protect his safety and also, you know, make sure the laws aren't broken. But what concerned me and what's concerned me really since, you know, 9/12, and here we are on the 7th anniversary of 9/11 last week, was that the equation between dissent and terrorism has almost become automatic with some law enforcement agents. In California in 2003, a member of the California Joint Terrorism Task Force said, if you're opposing a war on terrorism, a good argument can be made that you're actually engaging in terrorism yourself. And that seems to be the mentality.
It's absolutely frightening. Our guest again, Matt Rothschild, editor of The Progressive. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Matt, we had someone email in wanting your assessment of Obama, the Obama phenomenon, and then as a follow-up to that, wanting to know what Obama should do in light of his fall in the polls in the past couple weeks. What advice would you give him were he to call you? But first of all, what do you make of Obama?
Yeah.
Where do you take on?
The Progressive Nonprofit, we don't endorse candidates, and I have some problems with Barack Obama. I mean, I think we were just talking about this FISA bill. His signing of this FISA bill, endorsing it and voting for it in the Senate was outrageous. He had opposed it at the beginning, even threatened to filibuster it during the primaries, and then when it came on the floor of the Senate, he signed on to it. And this is a bill that basically not only immunizes the telecom companies from prior law violations, but immunizes them prospectively, not just retroactively, but prospectively, and lets Bush off the hook for his law breaking. And so I was opposed to that. He is for Bill Clinton's welfare reform, which I thought was one of the worst things Bill Clinton ever did. You know, he's for expanding the military, and his health care program isn't exactly single-payer health care. So I have my problems with Barack Obama. I do, tactically, I think he should just not mention Sarah Palin's name anymore, because I think anytime he mentions it, it's a diversion. What worries me most, Bob, is racism. I think the race boils down to racism, and it because the objective conditions are so ripe for Democrats right now to win, and they will win more seats in the Senate and the House, and they should, all things being equal, win the White House, but all things aren't equal because a black man is running for president.
I don't know, Matt, if you've had the privilege to watch a lot of commercial television recently, but I watched some over the last few days. And I was struck with one of the ads McCain's running in heavy rotation, and ran it on Saturday Night Live last night, where he's basically running against the Republican Party. He's running as the real agents of change, the real mavericks, the real reformers. And you would think he was like a left-wing Democrat almost watching these ads, which tells you they think that's what the American people want to hear. But, you know, how can you, isn't there false advertising?
Well, it's totally false advertising. I mean, he's running like he's Jim Hightower. I mean, you know, it's just a joke. It's a bad joke. And it does tell you that a majority of Americans are progressive on a lot of issues, especially these issues on the economy, on corporate power, on media dominance, on raising the minimum wage, on giving people universal health care, on paying for college for our kids. I mean, this has been something that Bernie Sanders has said over and over again, and Paul Wellstone, before he died, said that progressive ideas, by and large, are majoritarian ideas, popular ideas. And McCain, you know, what can he do? He can't really run on Bush policies. But if you examine Bush's economic policies, and Palin regurgitated them finally after much prompting from Charlie Gibson, McCain's policies are the same as Bush's policies: less government regulation, less taxes on business, more free trade. Well, more free trade will, you know, destroy more manufacturing in this country. Less regulation is what got us Enron and Bear Stearns, and what spanked Fannie Mae, and what got the housing market in such duress right now.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. The phone number at WILL AM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number in the line is open, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now to a caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 2, Ford County. You're on the air with Matt Rothschild.
Hi, gentlemen. I'm a first-time caller.
Oh, welcome.
And I would like for you guys to address the media complicity and the public short memory of America's dynastic rule. I saw Barack Obama on Jay Leno and Jimmy Kimmel, and he said both times that Lynn Cheney had done a genealogy, and lo and behold, they're like six cousins of Dick Cheney and Barack Obama.
Well, to me, this idea of dynastic rule isn't what concerns me. The genealogy of Cheney and Obama, I think, has nothing to do with what policies Obama would ultimately carry out. So I don't put much stock in that. What concerns me a little more about Obama and a prior caller asked about that was on foreign policy. Sometimes Obama acts like the problems of the U.S. empire started in 2001 when Bush and Cheney came in. For instance, at Obama's acceptance speech, he said that we should go back to the bipartisan foreign policy consensus of the last two generations. And, I was just sitting there scratching my head. What is he talking about? The consensus that got us Vietnam, that got us to support the death squads in El Salvador, that got us to support Suharto in Indonesia, who killed 500,000 people and then invaded East Timor, the consensus that was Ronald Reagan in the war against the Contras. I mean, sometimes there's almost a studied naivete on Obama's part where he appears to be less intelligent than he actually is, which is just the opposite of Bush and of Palin, who pretend to be smarter than they actually are.
You know, Matt Rothschild, what about the way the Iraq war has sort of evolved as an issue in this campaign and how it's been covered? Because early in the presidential race, Obama's one of the key factors, I think, that accounted for his ability to leap out of the head of the pack, especially against Senator Clinton, was the fact that he had been opposed to the invasion of Iraq prior to the invasion, and she had voted for the invasion. And that was one sort of key issue everyone could understand there's a difference. If you were anti-war, you went the Obama route. Yet, and here we are, Obama's running now against probably, aside from Joe Lieberman and someone, no member of Congress has been more outgoing and enthusiastic and supportive of not only the existing war, but of ramping it up and extending it and expanding it. Yet it seems like the Iraq war is not much of an issue.
It isn't. It isn't in the polls. I mean, the economy is three times more important an issue for Americans than the Iraq war. Maybe it's because even Bush himself has agreed that there needs to be a time horizon or a withdrawal deadline, is the way Obama puts it. Obama's response to the Iraq war initially was right on target, that it was an illegitimate war and it was a mistake. It should never be waged. Whereas you had McCain, who was fronting for the war even in October 2002, that comes out again in that movie I mentioned by Phil Donahue, Body of War, where it has footage of McCain. And Obama's right to say it's still a strategic blunder, even if this surge was a tactical success when combined with other things that happened in Iraq that made the insurgency go down. I don't think it's time to declare victory in Iraq. I do think it's time to get out of Iraq. The thing that concerns me most about Obama is that he wants to shift more troops to Afghanistan, and Afghanistan could simply be the next Iraq.
I take it you're not excited about the idea of ramping up more troops to Afghanistan to sort of finish off the Taliban?
Yeah, I don't think that's going to work. I mean, the United States has tried war in Iraq and tried war in Afghanistan. And war in Afghanistan, I mean, how many wedding parties is the United States going to, bomb? And every time the United States kills a bride and groom or other civilians, I don't want to make total light of it. I mean, the United States has killed a lot of civilians over in Afghanistan, and that is not making the people of Afghanistan happy about the U.S. presence there. It has actually driven them into the arms of the Taliban.
Matt Rothschild, something that sort of slipped beneath the radar of many Americans, even those who follow the news closely, because of the presidential race getting all the attention really for the last 10 days or 2 weeks since the conventions, has been what's going on in U.S.-Latin American relations. Really quite dramatic story taking place down there with Bolivia and Venezuela and the United States, perhaps extending to many of the other countries in the region. I know your website has some coverage of this. And maybe you could just give our listeners a thumbnail of what's been taking place and what's at stake and what, in your view, this country ought to be talking about when it comes to Latin America, how we ought to understand what's taking place in places like Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador.
Well, it's a really important question, Bob. And, we celebrated or commemorated 9/11 last week, and Latin America had its own 9/11 many years before we did, and that was September 11, 1973, when the Chilean military, led by Pinochet and supported by the U.S. government, overthrew the democratically elected government of socialist Salvador Allende. And after that, more than 3,000 people were murdered by this junta, and thousands more were disappeared and tortured. And it took a couple decades for those scars to heal. But in the last 10 years or so, there's been a real democratic rebellion against Washington in most countries in Latin America, and against the free market neoliberal policies that so devastated the economies and reduced people's earning powers there, and a desire among politicians in Latin America to stop dancing to America's tune whenever they try to pull the strings. So you had Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who was almost overthrown or was overthrown for 24 hours mm-hmm. in a coup that was supported by not just the Bush administration, but the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Both editorialized and supported it like the moment it happened.
It was unbelievable. Did they have egg on their face, you know, 36 hours later when Chavez was restored back to power because he had some support within the military, even in the palace, evidently. And so you have Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, who's very strong now, and he's been elected democratically several times. This guy is not a dictator. And Evo Morales, who just won another referendum, a recall referendum that he stomped all over on, winning a huge popular mandate. And yet the forces that are aligned with Washington in Bolivia, that are funded by Washington, are trying to overthrow Evo Morales and start a civil war in Bolivia. So the Bolivians expelled the U.S. ambassador. The Venezuelans expelled the U.S. ambassador. And Chavez said if there's going to be civil war in Bolivia, he's going to come in on the side of Evo Morales. And so there, this is a serious issue as to whether Washington still has its boot on the neck of Latin America, or whether Washington is so distracted now by the Iraq war and the Afghanistan war that it can't do its traditional mischief in Latin America.
You know, let's just follow up on this, and I want to get back to the phone lines, Matt Rothschild. But let's assume that even if the United States had no resource difficulties with having a military action or getting involved in Latin America, no qualms about it. The way the political climate has changed in Latin America with all these very popular elected governments, which are anti-neoliberal and which, while not necessarily socialist, are certainly committed to nationalist regimes that put the affairs of their country, the poor people in their country, at least in larger footing than they traditionally had. Could the United States actually win? I mean, in this climate, unlike, say, 30 years ago, is there any end game that has the United States getting pro-U.S. governments in that can win elections and not making the United States even more hated if it's seen as overthrowing elected governments?
Well, it certainly would be more hated. Whether it's feasible now, whether the United States has the power to pull a coup as it did in 1973, that is an open question. I hope the answer to that open question is no. That is that the people of these countries, of Venezuela, of Uruguay, of Bolivia, would resist this and would take control of their own country despite the U.S. Meddling in trying to topple their elected leaders. What would winning look like if the United States were able to topple one of these democratically elected governments? To my mind, it would be back to a Chile dictatorship.
Well, that is a frightening thought. Our guest today, Matt Rothschild, editor of The Progressive. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. The phone number here at WILLAM 580-333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our toll-free number right now for callers from waiting patiently. Spring Bay, you're on the air with Matt Rothschild.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I think that problem in Bolivia also is a north-south problem, and the governors in the southern part of that country control the vast wealth of the natural gas. And Morales wants to share some of that wealth, I think, with the poorer northern part of the country, and that's part of that conflict. I've been against the Iraq war from before it started, and you know, very much against the whole way that's come down. But I still don't feel like we've had an adequate conversation in this country in terms of now what's at stake. And take Al-Qaeda off the table, take weapons of mass destruction off the table. Why should we stay? Why should we leave? It's been a disaster for the United States. I think that we've militarized our economic interests in terms of oil. And if we leave now, what will be the result in the Middle East? Will Russia, will Iran, will China move into that vacuum? Are we there now trying to hold some wall against that and trying to continue to extract those resources to the West. So I just throw that out for discussion, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Matt, that's an interesting question. What is the U.S. obligation to the future in that region and protecting that region from being a plaything for Russian or Chinese imperialism?
Well, but the amazing thing about the question from the caller, and I'll get to an answer, and I think it's a legitimate question. I don't want to make fun of the question, but the amazing thing about it is the shifting rationales even to this day for why the United States should stay. First it was Saddam Hussein, and then it was, you know, Al-Qaeda, then it's weapons of mass destruction, then it was, you know, democracy in the Middle East, or redrawing the map of the Middle East, or whatever the neocons want. And now, you know, we keep coming to fallback positions. And I think it was wrong for us to be there. We don't belong there. It's not our country. The Iraqis should try to resolve it by themselves.
And they don't want us there, apparently.
And they don't want us there. Maliki wants us out. Muqtada al-Sadr, who's probably still the most popular figure on the at the grassroots of Iraq, doesn't want us there. And so that really we shouldn't be there. We don't belong there. We should get out. I think one of the least compelling reasons to be there is the geopolitical reason to be there, because we're worried that Iran's going to get too strong. We should have worried about that in the first place if that was a real concern. Or China and Russia in their dealings with Iraq. And world oil supplies, if we're there for world oil supplies, you know, we weren't allowed to say that practically on the air before the war started. This was going to be a war about oil, that dirty little three-letter word. Bush has started to talk about oil now as far as why we're staying in Iraq, and the caller mentions it. You know, the world oil supply is determined by the supplies in every country, not just in Iraq. And though the U.S. wanted to get control of that oil and get U.S. oil companies like ExxonMobil to make profits off of that oil, that's too is not a legitimate reason to stay in Iraq.
Matt Rothschild, before we get back to the phone lines, one of the really interesting developments politically in the United States over the last, since 9/11, but going back a little bit earlier, but it's really taken off, has been on the political right in the United States. We've had politicians within the Republican Party like Ron Paul, and now Bob Barr, a former Republican congressman who led the impeachment campaign against Bill Clinton, who is now the Libertarian candidate for president. And both of these conservatives are running on strong civil liberties campaigns. I know that both oppose the Patriot Act, and both are really talking about state suppression of civil liberties. What do you make of this?
Well, I welcome it. I welcome as many voices out there as possible standing up for civil liberties. I welcome a split within the Republican Party between the neocons and, you know, the libertarian right. For instance, Bob Barr used to work for the ACLU. Yeah. I mean, he got out of Congress, worked for the ACLU, now he's running as a libertarian. I mean, libertarians I agree with on social issues. I don't think the government should be in our bedroom or in our TV room or, you know, telling us who we should marry and who we shouldn't. But libertarians are just so 180 degrees wrong about the economy, because they think there should be no regulation of corporations. And it is these huge corporations that are ruining our economy and distorting our politics and our media. And so the idea that we should leave these huge behemoths alone, let them trample all over us, makes no sense to me.
And that's Ron Paul's economics as well, if I'm not mistaken. Let's go back to the phone lines. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Matt Rothschild, our guest today, editor of the Progressive Magazine. Let's go now to line one, Champagne. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to call attention to something that you briefly mentioned a little bit ago, but I actually thought this was a really important story this past week, where it became clear that Bush is increasing not only CIA operations, but also specifically military operations within Pakistan, and specifically targeting the period just prior to the elections. The reports that were coming through NPR and elsewhere were clearly suggesting, at least forcefully, that this was September and October were being targeted. And, of course, on the one hand, there's the issue of the election and the sort of attempt to perhaps to shape public opinion. But secondly, what I thought was sort of shocking in all of this is that at this point, do we all simply, in the press included, accept the Bush Doctrine? No one questioned whether this was illegal for him to be sending in directly ordering the military to do this sort of thing. Basically, the press, I'm wondering whether the international press has called attention to this issue. It reminds me very much of Cambodia and the Vietnam War, but in those days, people were outraged, right?
Yeah, Matt?
Yeah, it's an excellent point. I mean, the question is, how long does the warrant that Congress, the blank check that Congress gave Bush after 9/11 to wage war, how long is that good for? Is that good indefinitely? Is it good if Barack Obama becomes president or if McCain becomes president? I mean, Obama and Bush are identical right now on their position, evidently, as far as going into Pakistan without the Pakistani government's permission. That used to be called an act of war. But the language of the resolution that Congress passed giving Bush powers to fight those who attacked us on 9/11, those powers were so vast, and this is why Barbara Lee was the only person who voted against it. The powers were so vast that, you know, this president or any president could take that piece of legislation out of his pocket at any time and says, I'm fighting those people who bombed us on 9/11, and so I have congressional approval to go wage war against X, Y, and Z. I
mean, isn't the Patriot Act a lot of the rationale used by the Bush administration in all the dealings, its illegal dealings that have been uncovered, that this sort of, they have the blank check that the executive is not, can't be held accountable by the Constitution in any period that the executive determines as a time of national crisis?
Yeah, the Bush administration, Bush and Cheney especially, Cheney and Addington, have developed this idea that the commander-in-chief's powers in the Constitution, which are about a paragraph long compared to the 20-some paragraphs that are granted to Congress, that power is supreme over all other branches of government, and that the President of the United States can say, you know, my powers as Commander-in-Chief allows me to torture people. And they have said that, essentially.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild. Before we go back to the phone lines, Matt, I just wanted to step back for a second, because we follow the political debates in the presidential campaign closely, what's being talked about and how the media is covering it. But, you know, standing back for a second, what do you think, if you could say there were two or three issues you would like to see debated by John McCain and Barack Obama and the third party candidates for that matter, but especially the Barack Obama and John McCain, to get before the American people, to have them take positions on, to get into the public dialogue, what are the issues missing that you'd like to see there?
Well, the first issue is how to restore our civil liberties, and we've talked a lot about that. But what parts of the Patriot Act need to be repealed, the Military Commissions Act, or are we going to keep going in this anti-democratic direction? So that would be one. The another one is this question of U.S. empire. Do we really need soldiers in 128 countries around the world? And can we be an empire? Should we be an empire and still be a democracy? I think the answer to that is no, we can't be a democracy, that the tools we use to repress other people in other countries to keep the empire going are being slowly turned on our own citizens, not just the subjects of the empire. And the third one is, are we going to have a floor of decency in this country? And by that, I don't mean moral or cultural decency. I mean economic decency, so that people don't have to worry about being in poverty. People don't have to be worrying about going hungry, and there are 35 million people in this country who go hungry. People don't have to worry about going without health insurance. Or are we just going to have people scrape around in the most primitive capitalism with every boss holding a gun to their heads?
Our guest, Matt Rothschild. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Let's go back to the phone lines now. Line 2, Champaign County. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Matt Rothschild.
Hi. Yeah, I thought foreign policy might figure, but as you pointed out, Bush escalating in Pakistan is just implementing what Obama was already calling for, and it is very distressing. There's so much of that that I know a lot of people are just throwing up their hands about the election. I agree that internally there are going to be a lot of differences, but I'm particularly distressed. And you haven't mentioned the towards the new Cold War. Chomsky just had a very long piece on Counterpunch. I don't know how you're handling it with your paper, but I was even distressed that Chomsky didn't mention the role of Israel in that conflict. It's not much commented on here, but you can find it if you look for it. The defense minister of Georgia is a dual national. He's Israeli as well as Georgian. The Blackwater equivalent in Israel, paramilitary and training group, was right in there with the U.S. military in training the Georgian forces. It's difficult to talk about Israel, period, in a lot of circumstances, and it hasn't really come up here. I'm worried about the most recent arms sales that are being shipped. That attack on Iran is either being planned by Israel, or that they know the retaliation would be against Israel if the U.S. does it. So you can hear my frustration, and I'm applaud to Bob that you're going to have Finkelstein on again, because I think he has an important contribution to this discussion, even as difficult as it is. So I'll leave it at that and ask you to react. Thanks.
Well, also, let me ask you, Matt, when you react. I was unfamiliar with the Georgia connection. I don't know if you know much about that.
I don't, unfortunately. The only thing that jumped into my mind about Georgia there was Sarah Palin's comment that the Russian invasion of Georgia was unprovoked, when it was quite clearly provoked. It was wrong. It was against international law, and it was bad that Russia did it. But to say it was unprovoked is to be completely ignorant.
I guess she didn't get that far in her cramming session.
No, I guess that was on the cards for the next morning. But you know, the caller makes a good point, and I suppose if I had a fourth issue that I thought I'd wanted to have debated in the presidential debates, it would be this question of Israel and Palestine, because until that issue is resolved, which is to say until Israel gives Palestinians a decent and just state of their own, there's going to be huge chaos throughout the Middle East. There's going to be daily furtherance of anti-Israel and anti-U.S. sentiment around the world, especially in the Arab and Muslim world. There'll be increasing acts of anti-Semitism around the world. I mean, none of that is good for Jews, and I'm a Jewish American. I don't think it's good for Israel long-term to be a brutal colonial oppressor as it's been. And so I think they need to resolve that. But the United States has a key role, because we give $3 billion, $4 billion allowance to Israel every year.
Now, Matt Rothschild, the dominant opinion, the way Israel-Palestine relations are covered in the U.S. news media, is that either this is an unsolvable problem, it's hopeless, so we just have to reinforce Israel, or the only solution will be when Palestine comes to its senses, abandons any whatever claims it currently has, and accepts what Israel is willing to give it. Do you think there's another, there's a plan C?
Yeah, I mean, plan C is obvious. Return to the 67 borders, get rid of the settlements, get out of the occupied territories, recognize Palestine at the 67 borders. Then Saudi Arabia has already agreed that it would recognize Israel if it did that. I think a lot of the other Arab countries would recognize Israel. Why not try that peaceful route? I mean, the idea that Israel is going to be imperiled militarily when it's sitting there with 200 or 300 nuclear weapons, I mean, that's just a falsehood.
Were you struck by, I mean, I don't want to dwell on this much further because we have a couple callers I do want to get to, but I was struck by Sarah Palin, sort of the one line she seemed to learn about that was, you know, whatever Israel does, we will never question it, which was almost, I mean, if she said that about any other country, you know, you'd say, well, you should be running for the president of another country, not this one.
I mean, it was just robotic, wasn't it? I mean, that was pathetic. But, yeah, I mean, she was told to say this, and this only, obviously. I mean, that was the only way I could interpret that interview. And if another, you know, client of the United States, which is what Israel is, it's an outpost of the U.S. empire, and it serves the interests of the U.S. empire. That's why the United States support it, not because there's this cabal of Jews around who run the world. You know, if we were giving $3 billion or $4 billion to another country, I would hope that we would want to tell that country, you know, whether it should go, you know, bomb another country or not.
Our guest, Matt Rothschild. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Let's get back to the phone lines, where we've got a couple callers who have been waiting patiently. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Matt Rothschild.
Yes. I wanted to ask, who are the mainstream liberal media? And I would like to know when we are going to get our government to tell us what they are doing in our foreign policy. How can we know when there are secrecy and CIA operatives in other countries? And how can we get some of that? I think we finally realized what our foreign policy in the last 40 years has led us to. Thank you. Taking my call.
Thank you very much, caller. Matt Rothschild, who are the mainstream liberal media, and are we ever going to get the truth about what the United States is doing around the world?
Well, I think the mainstream liberal media is the New York Times and the Washington Post and CBS News and maybe CNN and maybe ABC and NBC. I mean, those certainly are the biggest members, the LA Times and the Chicago Tribune, perhaps in there as well, and the Wall Street Journal. Are they telling us what's going on in the world? They don't. And they but occasionally, I mean, the New York Times will report on crucial things out there. But, you know, you've got to be able to grab them as they're coming through. And sometimes the coverage is really tilted, as I think one of their main Latin American correspondents seems very hostile to what's going on in Venezuela and Bolivia right now. So you have to deduct for bias there. What happens most of the time is these mainstream liberal media groups, like other corporate media groups, they will follow the dictates of the president of the United States. The president is the assignment editor, by and large, for the mainstream media. And so if the president says we've got to go support Georgia, or the vice president says we've got to go support Georgia, then everyone pretty much marches to that line and they don't try to interpret things differently. That's why it's important to read the alternative media and also to check out some foreign media, which is so much easier to do now in the Internet age.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, so let's go back to our last caller. Line 3, Champagne, you're on the air with Matt Rothschild.
Yes, I just wanted to make a quick comment and a quick question. And the comment is that, in my view, the biggest intellectual achievement of Republicans in the last 40 years has been to get chickens to vote for Colonel Sanders. And my question is this, that when Sarah Palin implied that she would get in a shooting war with Russia over Georgia, if somebody should have told her that it wasn't the Georgia that's on the east side of Alabama. And I would hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much, caller.
Well, I would hope she would know that much, but I have to say I'm not thoroughly convinced. You know, the Republicans have, at least since the days of Nixon, tried to get people to vote against their economic interests by appealing to their more base instincts, whether it be racism or other reasons, jingoism, for instance. And so there's a real question as to how mature the American public is going to be on November 4th and whether a sufficient number, frankly, of white Americans are going to be comfortable enough of voting for a black American, even though his policies on economic issues, which are so biting right now, are going to be better for them than McCain and Palin. And that remains to be seen.
Matt Rothschild, we've only got a couple minutes left in the show. And I'd like you to talk about the racism issue a little more. In your sense, following the press coverage, I know you devour the mainstream news media as much as anyone I know, both especially in television, but also in print now. Do you think there's been elements of racism and how a double standard, should I say, based on racial lines and how McCain and Palin have been treated as regard to how Obama's been treated?
Well, Palin, you know, if Palin were a or let's put it this way, if Obama had a daughter who was a teenager who had a child or was pregnant out of wedlock and had a kind of roughneck boyfriend who got her pregnant, I don't think you would see this, you know, glowing adulation about how wonderful the Palin family is in total.
You don't think Sean Hannity would salute them for being a wonderful example of a family?
No, you'd have all the prejudices about the culture of black America or the underclass and all this crap that we've been fed for generations now. And so that's one obvious place where the racism is coming in the coverage.
There's sort of an operating assumption in mainstream media that working class white Americans are much more racist than middle class white Americans. No one ever challenges that. It seems like an interesting assumption, and it comes almost entirely from middle class white Americans making it. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think it goes up and down the class ladder, actually, this race bias, and I don't think it is an affliction of the working class. And, you know, I saw a poll where 19% of white Americans don't think their white friends would vote for the black guy.
Matt Rothschild, I hear the band tuning up in the background. That's usually the sign they want to clear me out of the studio. Matt Rothschild, editor of the Progressive Magazine, has been our guest today. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer, for handling the show, and I want to thank Paul Diefenbaugh for working the board today. And Matt Rothschild, as always, thank you for joining us.
Bob, it's been my pleasure. Quite welcome.
I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters. I'll be back in 167 hours. Until then, have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
Despite the end of rainfall, runoff will continue to pose problems, especially in low-lying and flood-prone areas. So various flooding advisories may continue throughout the area. You should pay particular attention if you're driving, and don't drive into flooded areas. Find another route instead, especially after dark when it's difficult to judge the depth of standing water. Dry weather is expected as the work week begins. This is WILL AM 580 and FM 90.9 HD2 and HD3 Urbana, a service of the College of Media at Illinois. Yeah.